Shalom, and welcome to On the House, the podcast where you'll find everything you need to know about purchasing real estate in Israel. Hosted by Debbie Goldfischer, real estate consultant and founder and CEO of buyitinisrael.com. In each episode, Debbie sits down with leading industry experts to explore market trends, legal and tax issues, smart buying strategies, neighborhoods across Israel, and more. All this is On the House, helping you make the right move.
Shalom and welcome back to On the House, another episode of Season 7, a season dedicated to making Israel your home. Over the past few weeks, we've had the great pleasure of speaking with Rabbi Yehoshua Fass, co-founder and executive director of Nefesh B'Nefesh, who shared the incredible work they do helping Jews around the world return to Eretz Israel. We also had the privilege of sitting down with Israel advocate Hillel Fuld, who spoke passionately about why every Jew belongs in Israel, why the same script keeps repeating itself throughout Jewish history, and the clear opportunities, security, and sense of purpose that life in Israel offers. Today, I'm extremely honored to welcome another very special guest, someone who is deeply respected as a communal rabbi, a teacher, and a leader, both in North America and now here in Israel. Rabbi Stephen Brzezinski is a respected rabbinic leader, author, and speaker known for his thoughtful engagement with issues facing the Jewish people in Israel and the diaspora. He served for over 25 years as the rabbi of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey, one of the largest Orthodox synagogues in North America. After making Aliyah, Rabbi Brzezinski became active in teaching, writing, and communal leadership in Israel, bringing a strong religious Zionist perspective to his work. He is the author of several books on Jewish thought, law, and modern Jewish challenges, and regularly addresses audiences on topics related to Torah, Israel, and Jewish destiny. Rabbi Brzezinski continues to inspire through his teaching, writing, and leadership, offering a thoughtful and courageous voice on the challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish people today. I'm thrilled to have him with us today to share his insights and passion on Aliyah, religious Zionism, the future of American Jewry, and the spiritual mission of living in Israel. Rabbi Brzezinski, welcome to On the House.
Debbie, thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Before we dive into Aliyah and some of the bigger topics we're planning to cover today, I'd love to start on a more personal note. You've had such a long and distinguished career in communal leadership, and now after making Aliyah, you're still very active, teaching, writing, traveling, speaking to communities here and abroad. Can you share with us a little bit about your work today? What's your mission at this stage in life, and what message are you hoping to bring to Jews, both in Israel and around the world?
It's an essay question. I often say that I do the same thing these days that I did while I was in the active rabbinate, except I have no balabatim.
And no payroll.
No payroll. Not that there's anything wrong with balabatim. I enjoy that part of it as well, but it's a totally different type of rabbinate if you're not dealing with people on a day-to-day level. So essentially, I teach, I write, I speak, I learn, and I try to share the same messages that I shared all the years I was in the rabbinate in America, which is 35 years in all. I serve actually almost in a secular sort of position. I'm senior research associate at the Jerusalem Center for Applied Policy, jcap.ngo, which focuses like a think tank, but a policy-oriented think tank that aims to preserve the Jewishness of Yerushalayim. And we try to counter the threats that exist to that type of strong Jewish identity and burgeoning Jewish population. To wit, most people don't know this, but the second largest Arab city in Israel is what's called East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. There are over 300,000 Arabs there, and many of the Hamas is a very powerful force. So we were involved in JCAP in trying to get rid of UNRWA and try to reform their educational curriculum. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but there are many schools in Yerushalayim, Arab-run schools, that are subsidized by the Israeli Ministry of Education but use a Palestinian curriculum, which is rife with hatred of Israel. Crazy. So that's just one of the things that we do. Mm-hmm. And of course, I speak locally in the various shuls and I give shiurim, and thank God I'm able to do it in Hebrew and in English.
Incredible.
Which doubles my audience. And therefore, so I have one foot in the world of Torah in a very active way, and my other foot in the world of support for the state and the land of Israel.
Incredible. Thank you. So let's start with the basics. Can you explain to us what is religious Zionism and how would you define it?
Religious Zionism, I think, stems from the very foundation that there is an eschatological purpose to the Jewish people's return to the land of Israel. And by that, I mean it's part of the process of redemption. It's not just happenstance that the Jewish people return to the land of Israel, but it's rather the fulfillment of the biblical prophecies. Looked at it from that vantage point, it's actually an astonishing story to anyone who's familiar with the Bible. And of course, I mean Jews, Christians as well, they see that the whole narrative of the Torah is that God created a world and chose a people, the descendants of Avram, Abraham, gave them the Torah and brought them to the land of Israel. So the whole narrative of the Torah is God created the world, formed a people, and brought them to the land of Israel. And that's why we're here.
Simple as that.
It's as simple as that. Everything else, you know, sometimes we lose it. We lose the forest for the trees because we read it every week and we don't see the broader arc. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that's the reality. And then when you dig into some of the details, then we see that, well, our possession of the land of Israel is conditional on our fidelity to God and our observance of his law. And the Torah itself predicts that if we are unfaithful, we will be exiled, but we will eventually return to the land of Israel. And many of the Nevi'im, the prophets, embraced the exact same approach. Of course, they warned the Jewish people of what would happen if they continued to be disloyal to God. I'm actually learning now in depth the book of Yechezkel, Ezekiel, which is just morose. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the human attitudes that you find in Yechezkel, the people were so ingrained with an alien ideology that they did not think it was possible that they'd be wrong, to the extent that one of the commentaries says at a certain point that when the prophet criticized them for serving idols, and then the Babylonians came and there was a siege, their immediate thought was, we are not being faithful enough to our idols.
Oh my goodness.
Even though the prophet admonished them that they have to destroy the idols and return to God. That's how captive they were to that ideology.
Total blindness.
That blindness, that captivity to an ideology, of course, recurs throughout our history. It exists today as well. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too far afield, but the fact is, after everything that we've been through in Israel the last few years, the massacre of October 7th, there's still people who say it's because we didn't concede enough. We didn't give them more land. We didn't try to accommodate them even more. We didn't compromise enough. And if only we did that, then we'd be able to live in peace. Well, that mentality, that psychology is a human one. But you see, it goes back to biblical times. The point I want to make, though, is that when the prophets spoke to the people and exhorted them to repent, they said, if you do not repent, you will be exiled and the temple will be destroyed. And that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And they said as well, but eventually you'll return. And that's where religious Zionism comes in. The movement of return to the land of Israel is something which is a fulfillment of the prophetic vision. As we haven't seen the entire fulfillment yet, but who's to say it happens immediately, overnight?
Sure.
Could be a gradual process also. So therefore, I think that's at the very core of religious Zionism, that there's a spiritual significance to our return to the land of Israel. By the way, that places religious Zionism in contrast both to secular Zionism and the Haredi understanding of the state of Israel, which attributes to it no spiritual significance at all. In fact, you could say, I'm not trying to be offensive to anyone, but in that sense, the secular Zionist narrative and the Haredi narrative almost conflate, because both are saying there's little to no spiritual significance to our return to the land of Israel. The secular Zionists would say it's just a haven for Jews to live because the world has been so inimical, so hostile to our existence. And the Haredi narrative would be there is no political dimension that has any spiritual value, but there are mitzvot to be performed in the land of Israel, and that's the value of our being here. Religious Zionism is sort of a big tent in that we can accept that, yeah, Israel is a haven for Jews, and of course it's the tableau on which the mitzvot of the Torah are to be performed, but at the same time, there's also an enormous spiritual significance to our return to the land of Israel. And the religious Zionist impulse is to try to implement that vision and sanctify every aspect of life in the land of Israel. Can't ignore it and you can't reject it. You have to try to implement it gradually.
So how does a person come to embrace it? What are the choices and responsibilities that come along with it?
Well, I think that there are those three basic approaches that we have. In a sense, the secular Zionist vision accomplished a great deal. I mean, we are in their debt. We're soon to celebrate Yom HaTzmaut here. And no doubt, they were the prime movers in the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel. But they failed to invest it with any type of spiritual intensity. It was purely secular. Mm-hmm. They wanted to create a new Israeli. They wanted a place where old Jews would be safe.
The new Jew.
The new Jew. Well, that vision has failed. Yep. Because as we know from all the wars that we have and the threats of terror, that it's not always safe here. Begadol, the big picture, of course, is that we're safer here than any other place in the exile. Because the basic rule of Jewish history is that every exile, bar none, comes to an ignominious end, and Jews don't see it until it's too late. Mm-hmm. So that secular vision has more or less run its course, and I think part of the unrest that you find in Israeli society today in that segment of the population is the inability to recognize the bankruptcy of their vision and how it's not going to be fulfilled, mm-hmm. and they need something else.
Almost grappling onto something that they realize has failed.
And that's why you do find, even amongst the secular Israelis, and I think what happened to us here on October 7th played a significant role in that, a resurgence of Jewish identity, because they saw themselves as having an Israeli, they're Israelis, it's an Israeli identity, and their Jewishness is somewhat tangential. But on October 7th, and the horrors that were committed against us, it defies imagination why a particular enemy hates Israelis so much. What did Israelis ever do to them? But place it in the narrative of Jewish history, and knowing how Jews are hated, and it's a little more understandable because that's the nature of Jewish history. Mm-hmm. It's an attack not just on us, it's an attack on our God and his message. So what happened here, and we see playing out in society today, is that Israelis, even those who are victimized, and certainly we hear reports of Israelis in captivity, finally saying Shema for the first time in their lives and reciting brachot and being very careful even about basic mitzvot they never understood or embraced before. Why? It's because their Jewish identity came to the fore. And they realized they were not captured and are not being persecuted because they're Israelis. They're captured and persecuted because they're Jews.
Right.
And that's the big change that exists in society. Granted, there's resistance to it. So from that perspective, that vision has more or less, as its energy depleted. Mm-hmm. The Haredi world is growing because in a sense, it's a little simpler not to have to deal with the harshness, the difficulties of running a modern state and implementing the Torah's values, even the Torah's policy prescriptions on that particular state. It's easy just to separate and to segregate and to live holy lives, lives of devotion and piety, without getting involved in any nationalistic endeavors. It's an approach. And for many people, That is what they want. That's what they're looking for. Of course, you can't have a nation that way. And you certainly can't run or survive as a nation that way. And with the Haredi population growing, they're now under tremendous pressure, certainly externally, but also internally, to be able to find the balance between living lives that are fully according to the Torah and having a national life also. There's no contradiction. On the contrary, religious Zionism says that the way we implement the Torah in our personal and political lives is a fulfillment of the Torah.
Beautiful.
It's not a negation of the Torah. And that's the dichotomy that exists in today's world. And that's why if you want to triangulate, it's a good American word, if you want to triangulate, that's where religious Zionism finds itself.
Mm-hmm. Probably at the center.
At the center, correct. Of the vision that's purely secular.
Right.
And the vision, I don't want to say purely Torah, because it implies that in religious Zionism, it's not Torah, but Torah that has no powerful national dimension to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So our generation has an unbelievable opportunity, a precedented opportunity. From a Torah perspective, how do we see this moment in Jewish history?
I think if we look at Jewish history as one long book, we're coming very close to the last chapter. Because we see, both in terms of our political lives here, I mean, let's face it, we're surrounded by enemies. And enemies that are relentless, and enemies that are almost impossible to reconcile with, because their vision of our demise, God forbid, is religious.
Mm-hmm.
It's theological.
Frightening.
Yes. And therefore, that's how they see us. So not every country, of course. There are certain countries that have come to an accommodation with us, which is fine. Fine, it's actually quite welcome. I always get the sense, though, there's a difference between accommodation and acceptance. Would any of even the countries that have made peace with us, would they mourn our demise, God forbid? And I think not.
Well, many of them didn't even respond on October 7th. Well, where are they?
That's correct.
So
none have responded.
Proof.
Correct. Look at Egypt and Jordan. The people certainly are hostile. The governments have a sort of rapprochement with Israel in a political sense, because Israel benefits them in a number of ways. But nonetheless, you can't say it's a peace treaty. You know,
right.
They're not at peace like, you know, the U.S. is at peace with Canada. It's not quite the same. There may be no active hostilities. And the truth is, I always view these peace treaties as just an absence of war, not real peace.
Mm-hmm.
And to have an absence of war is also something that's very valuable and desirable, but it's not peace.
Not enough.
It's not the same.
Mm-hmm. So, halachically speaking, according to religious law, would you say that it's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Israel?
I think everybody maintains it's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. There was an opinion in Tosafot towards the end of Masechet Ketubot, one of the commentaries on the Talmud, that he said that in our time, he's talking 900 years ago, in our time it's not a mitzvah because it's dangerous to get there. We can't properly fulfill the mitzvot in the land of Israel. That's Rabbeinu Chaim. But there are people who accept that to this day, but the fact is the points are now actually not entirely relevant because it's not so dangerous to travel here anymore, and you can fulfill the mitzvot in the land of Israel. So his reality is not our reality, and to pretend that what he ruled back then in medieval times is still applicable today is a stretch. Ramban, for example, one of the great medieval commentators, said explicitly that it's a Torah obligation to live in the land of Israel. It's an affirmative commandment. Ramban, Nachmanides, wrote this. It's in what he called the mitzvot that the Rambam forgot in the Rambam's book of mitzvot, number 4. And he said it's a mitzvah in every generation to conquer the land of Israel, to dwell in it. And that's a mitzvah incumbent upon every individual. That's the Ramban. Others disagree, but the Rambam, for example, who doesn't write explicitly that dwelling in the land of Israel is an affirmative commandment, there's a lot of discussion amongst the decisors about why he did or didn't write it. But even he refers to the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel in a number of places, and therefore, clearly it's a mitzvah. many Jews rely on the interpretation of Reb Moshe Feinstein. Zecher Tzadik Livracha is one of the great halachic decisors in America. He died now about 40 years ago, and he distinguished between two types of commandments: affirmative commandments, meaning things you have to do, or things you don't have to do, but if you do them, you fulfill a mitzvah by doing them. So he placed living in the land of Israel in the second category. Mm-hmm. He said it's not obligatory, but nonetheless,
but if you do it,
you fulfill a mitzvah. And as opposed to many others who said, no, it's an obligatory mitzvah. And it's not even a question of points, all right? We all want to score runs on the scoreboard. I hope the baseball reference is not lost on you. We all want to score the runs, but living in the land of Israel, so the sages tell us, it's shkula kineged kol mitzvot. It's the equivalent that corresponds to all the mitzvot.
All of them, wow.
Right, so what does that mean? It means, yeah, it's a very important mitzvah for sure. But what it means is that our fulfillment of that particular mitzvah of dwelling in the land of Israel impacts our fulfillment of all other mitzvot. Mm-hmm. And therefore, unquestionably, our observance of Shabbat here, our observance of Kashrut here, our observance of any mitzvah in the Torah here in the land of Israel is going to be superior by definition to the fulfillment of that particular mitzvah elsewhere in the world. It's because the mitzvot were designed to be fulfilled in the land of Israel.
Love that. So you said you were a community rabbi for close to 35 years.
35 years, yes.
Over those decades, did you sense a growing interest among your community members in making Aliyah? Was there a movement towards Israel in those years?
When I was a rabbi first in Kew Gardens Hills in the 80s, so it was not a high point for Aliyah. We had a very small shul mm-hmm. in Kew Gardens Hills, about 70 families. And I remember one year, four families made Aliyah.
That's a lot.
That was a lot. It was about 15% of the Aliyah from America that year.
Wow.
All right. And in Teaneck, when I was there, I haven't been sure, every year you had one or two families, sometimes more. There's always an interest. And a lot of rabbis shy away from speaking about Aliyah because it raises obvious but uncomfortable question. Why don't you practice what you preach? Mm-hmm. And that becomes the fantasy of the congregant that the rabbi will get up and say, I'm leaving, all right? And so rabbis don't want to be in a position of speaking about something that they are not prepared to do themselves. I did it in any event. Not often, but I did it often enough. Mm-hmm. Certainly at high points of the year, like Shabbat Gadol, Shabbat Shuvah, and I always end with some type of peroration about the land of Israel and how whatever I was speaking about that particular Shabbat, it puts us in a good historical perspective of where we are in the process of redemption and what our personal obligations are. So what I would always say is that everyone should make Aliyah, but everyone must calculate every year or so, what can I do to make Aliyah? How can I facilitate my Aliyah? And at least think about it. If you're not thinking about it, so you're not part of the mitzvah at all, and you've divorced yourself from Jewish destiny. But if you think about it, and that's of course the first stage, no one just stumbles into the land of Israel. If you start thinking about it, how can I do it? Can I get a job there? How will my children manage there? If that's part of the mitzvah of Aliyah.
Beautiful. When you made Aliyah, did you leave family behind in America?
So we're blessed now that all our children live in the land of Israel. But
what a bracha.
Yes, wow. Indeed, all children and grandchildren. But two sets of the children preceded us here, and two other children and their spouses followed us here.
So when you left?
We left, we had two children there. And we never demanded that they make Aliyah. And I think we might have had an assumption that they would mm-hmm. if they could. But within 3 years after we were here, the entire family was here as well.
So I see that very often. People have to take the jump, make a sacrifice, and slowly the rest follow. It's unbelievable. I've seen it so many times.
Right. So in our case, two daughters made that leap first. Mm-hmm. And but we've been coming here. I mean, I've been to Israel before I made Aliyah probably close to 70, 75 times. Mm. But in Modi'in, we first came here in 2007. and I was on sabbatical, and we came here. And then over the years, I'd always find some excuse to come to the land of Israel.
Amazing.
At least four or five times. It's a conference, whatever. I always find some reason to be here.
Right.
Notwithstanding, I had a 24/7 job. And part of it, we used to take people from the shul here every year. There was always a reason to come. And so I became very comfortable in Modi'in over the years. Mm-hmm. And when we made Aliyah here in 2020, it wasn't new. We'd been living here for so long. I knew where the stores were and where to daven and all those things which sometimes confound a newcomer. So thank God I was blessed that I already knew that.
Amazing. So what would you say to someone who is desperate to be here? Their heart is in Israel, but they're finding it incredibly hard to leave the family, the parents, their support network, their work, their jobs.
It is a reality, and I think even for us, it was a bit of an inhibition for us over the years because you don't want to leave family. I tell people you only live once, and therefore you have to make a decision that's right for you in the moment. I think it was much more difficult many years ago, before FaceTime and before Zoom, when you were, I still remember when your only contact with the world outside was through aerograms, and you'd write.
Gosh.
When I learned in Israel, it's now 50 years ago, 1975, there were no phones.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to call my parents, I had to go to the main post office in Yerushalayim and buy 4 minutes.
Wow.
And sit in a booth. You have to wait in line, sit in a booth, and they'd warn you that you have 10 seconds left. And that will be it.
So I'm a little bit younger. When I was in seminary, we had to buy our simonim and just drop them in those little coins with a hole in the middle. And they would just, you just hear them drop, drop, drop.
One after the other.
What a contrast to today.
That's correct.
They video call their moms. What should I have for lunch?
Right. So I call my parents before Rosh Hashanah and before Pesach. And that
you
was
probably
it.
Probably had a very meaningful year.
And that, well, now it's completely different.
Completely.
Because the kids talk to their parents 3-4 times a day. So if that's the case for students living here, it's equally the case for people who make Aliyah.
Sure.
The level of a constant interaction they could have with a family back home was unimaginable even 30 years ago, much less 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think, therefore, that part of it has been ameliorated. But there is the day-to-day involvements that you lose, being able to stop in at someone's house and all that is true. It's undeniable. But I would say the fact is that when you live in Israel, you become a magnet for your parents and your siblings. And certainly if you're of that age, for your children to come.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a common dynamic that I saw even in Bnei Asher and in Teaneck, if a child will make Aliyah, within a very short time, the parents would find a place to purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And they would wind up coming more. And that gives everybody a foothold.
Absolutely.
If not a leasehold in the land of Israel.
Absolutely. And that's why we're here, because I truly believe that buying a home is part of the journey. It's, as you said, a magnet. I call it an anchor. It brings people home.
It's an anchor. That's a good word. Mm-hmm. Because once they have that here, they'll want to visit more and more. And they start coming for Yomim Tovim. And they remain involved in the lives of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, the first time I came to Israel, it was 1969. I was but a child at the time. And it was a long, long flight because the planes weren't as fast. I think we stopped in Amsterdam just to switch planes.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 17, 18-hour trip, all told. It was very long.
Goodness.
The flights are much quicker. It's much more pleasant. And
incomparable.
That's correct.
Yeah. Since you've been living here, are you hearing from more people, friends, former congregants expressing more interest in Aliyah? Are you seeing a shift in the mindset of American Jewry?
I think I did first during the coronavirus pandemic, because people then sensed they were cut off from the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes people who didn't have children here, but people just wanted to visit, who wanted to feel connected.
It's a very uncomfortable feeling.
And for the first time in their lives, they were told, no, you can't come. You're not a citizen. You can't come.
Crazy.
Right.
Wow.
And that was a wake-up call to a lot of Jews who do see Israel as a haven in turbulent times. And then once the war started, there was this reassertion of Jewish identity, and people felt a deeper connection to the land of Israel. And there was a sense that Aliyah would spiral, skyrocket. I was always a little skeptical of that. And in fact, I think the numbers are the same, were even less than expected. A lot of people opened up Aliyah files, but practically not as many people made Aliyah as they thought they would. And I think it comes from a number of reasons. And this is something I've discussed in different forums, even spoken about this publicly. There are basically three reasons why people make Aliyah: fear, guilt, and virtue. And I've always felt that fear never works. Yeah, if someone is in one of the depressed countries, if you're fleeing, the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, then yeah, that means you're running from something. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, American Jews do not see themselves as running from something. And even if you say that, we see the news and a Jew in New York had his yarmulke knocked off and someone was knocked down in the street and injured. It's true there are certain dangers that exist in American Jewish life, some that didn't exist in the past. You can't compare it, though, to what happens in Israel, where we live with a sense that an enemy wants to kill us. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that to try to tell American Jews they should make Aliyah, because if not, they'll be killed, it's not a winning argument, because the reality is not like that. Another way is guilt, to say to them, look, we're fighting, we're suffering, so you can come on Hanukkah or Pesach and sit in a hotel. How do you live with yourself? Or maybe it's a little more persuasive, but it's not entirely persuasive, because people make their own decisions and live their own lives, and no one likes to feel guilty. And the fact is that Aliyah that comes from fear is probably more successful than Aliyah that comes from guilt. But the best motivation for Aliyah is what I call virtue. And that is, you want to come to the land of Israel and dwell here because that's what God wants of a Torah Jew, right?
Right.
So I say, it's not you're running from something, you're running towards something.
Beautiful.
And that type of enthusiasm, that idea of, I want to live in the land of Israel because this is the ultimate fulfillment of the Torah Jew, to learn Torah and serve Hashem and fight in the army and build his ideal Jewish state in the land of Israel. That is the type of Aliyah that more or less will be successful, because it is endowed with a much deeper sense of commitment and reality. And that's the type of Aliyah I try to encourage. And I think at Teaneck we had, thank God, a very good record of every year families would go, and they became these sorts of anchors that we had, and we'd visit them, we'd all get together. They're running towards something.
Yep.
They're saying, I want to be part of that, and I'm not just running away from something which I cannot be part of anymore or which threatens me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that being said, I can mention earlier, every exile comes to a tragic end. That's the reality of Jewish history. There is no haven outside the land of Israel. And we see the way, I mean, the Kibbutz Goliot that has taken place over the last 100 years, that Jews from 130, 140 different countries are now congregated in the land of Israel. And there are people I know, I've heard them, who deny that the ingathering of the exiles has taken place because they didn't get the proclamation. You know, they didn't see it in writing. But the reality is, it's unfolding in front of us. This is it.
Literally, don't
wait for it. This is it. Mm-hmm. This is Kibbutz Goliot. This is what it looks like. Mm-hmm. It may not be what you fantasized about or what you taught yourself or thought might be, but this is the reality. We hear from 140 different countries speaking 180 different languages, which is why we never have a good dialogue in Israel, speaking so many different languages. But this is it. If that's the case, it means we are at a very momentous time in Jewish history.
Definitely.
Because if all the exiles are gathering in the land of Israel, and we're all trying to find our way, not just how to live together, but how to build that model Jewish state that does not simply mimic Western values and certainly not Middle Eastern values, yeah, there are going to be some edgy times and some public dissatisfaction, but nonetheless, that is the challenge of our times. And Jews across the world have the opportunity to be part of that. Why would you not want to be part of that? Anyone who takes Judaism seriously wants to be part of that, because we've been praying for this for 2,000 years. And now that it's come to say, yeah, not yet, you know, not yet. I'm not ready yet, but this is what we're praying for. And the truth is that people should think about this, because I did every day when I lived in America. Every day we say three times in the davening, V'kabitzenu me'arba kanfot ha'aretz, T'kabit shofar gadol l'cheritenu. Sound the great shofar for our freedom, and gather us from the four corners of the earth. Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you, O God, mikabetz nitchei amo Yisrael, who gathers in the scattered of Israel. And I would think to myself every day, and I'm not exaggerating, all it takes is a ticket. And now the ticket is even free. They'll pay for you to come.
That's amazing. So I think about that bracha when I look at the analytics of our website. We have the Biden Israel website. It's phenomenal. Any time of day or night, there's traffic from all over the world. America, Australia, Canada, the US, the Far East, you name it, all over, South America, Europe. And it's like Kibbutz Galiot.
Right. So we're asking God every day for something that he's given us in his grace and compassion, the power and capacity to do. So What do we keep asking him for? It's as if asking for, in the other bakashot, the other request, asking for knowledge, but never opening up a book.
Right.
Asking for health and living on a healthy lifestyle. Asking for parnasa, sustenance, and never working.
Got to do your part.
We have to do our share. Right. And it's the same thing is true with this bracha, this blessing of the ingathering of the exiles, which we say three times a day.
Wow. So do you believe that all Jews should ultimately live in Israel, or is there a value, even a necessity, in maintaining a Jewish presence outside of Israel?
There is such an argument. There was a time, even in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, that Jews lived outside the land of Israel, but they were sent on specific missions. Mm-hmm. In other words, we always had trade. Trade was always important. So you had Jewish traders living in what we call today Turkey, or living in the Arabian Peninsula, but they were bonded to the land of Israel. Mm-hmm. Their presence there in these other countries were designed to promote the interests of the Jews living in the land of Israel.
And their work today could have been done remotely, by the way.
That's correct. Today it's totally
everything's digital.
Today it's totally different. So therefore, there are people who say, I heard this argument for decades already, that if all American Jews left, then what would happen to the American support for Israel? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not such a strong argument anymore, because the fact is a lot of American Jews are not that supportive of Israel. And some of them are actually, quote, quite vocal being against Israel. The core of Jewish support for Israel in America comes from the Christian evangelicals, not from the Jews. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that argument carries a little less weight. It carries even less weight when we realize that America's relationship to Israel today is an alliance of shared interests and values. Israel's not a pity case. It's not a beggar nation with our arms or our mouths at the trough. We give a lot to America, and America gives a lot to us. So it's a real alliance. It's a real friendship. Mm-hmm. One of the presidents said to me that certain countries in the world, he mentioned Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is an ally, but Israel's a friend. And that's a friend is also an ally, but a friend is someone with whom you have shared values. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we shouldn't think that if no Jews live in America anymore, all of a sudden American support for Israel would end. Again, that presupposes that any particular administration supports Israel because of the presence of American Jews. And I think that thing has been refuted very cogently over the last few decades. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, Jews are a waning political force in America, sad to say.
Yep.
In the Democratic Party, for example, now it's the home of many Jews, if not most Jews, but the Democrat Party is not unhostile to the land of Israel, right. And elements of it are openly hostile to the land of Israel. And you have Republican administrations that are much friendly to the land of Israel who get very little Jewish support. I remember Trump said this. I was actually at the White House when he said it. Doesn't understand why American Jews don't support him. Right. He's the best president Israel's ever had. And the answer he doesn't want to hear, he doesn't know, most American Jews are not that supportive of Israel. They're supportive in a big way. They won't be. I used to say that if a Democrat is not openly hostile to Israel, that, or antagonistic to Israel, then that's enough for a Jew to support him. Mm-hmm. And that's been the reality for the last several decades. You can't say openly antagonistic and hateful things about Israel. Then you'll lose support from some. I mean, Bernie Sanders is an example of a Jew who is very aggressive, very bellicose towards Israel, and he has the Jewish supporters also. The bottom line is American Jewry, I don't want to get too far afield, but American Jewry is collapsing under the weight of intermarriage. And so many of the people now we perceive, or the media perceives, as speaking as Jews, it's not just that they're not halachic Jews, many of them, but even those who are the products of intermarriage, mm-hmm. and they don't really have a very strong Jewish identity, and therefore they don't understand this sort of what they consider an ethnic attachment to the state or land or people of Israel, mm-hmm. and that's why this hostility erupts, as opposed to, say, the evangelicals who have no ethnic attachment. But their attachment to us comes through the Bible, mm-hmm. in which they believe, and in which, sad to say, most American Jews do not. And that's why their commitment, certainly the older generation, or much more biblically based, their commitment to support for the state of Israel is much stronger than you'll find, much more passionate also, than you'll find amongst the bulk of American Jewry.
Incredible. Going back to the alliance between Israel and America, do you think that will last after Trump?
It all depends on who's in the next administration. So the Democrats, it's very hard to find a pro-Israel voice that could be a leader of the party, because the party now is filled not just with identity politics and the nuttiness of a critical theory and intersectionality, but the Democrat Party, they're not so enamored with America and American ideals. Mm-hmm. And certainly the notion of a nation state that's based on a religion is anathema to them. So it's hard to see in the Democratic Party, how you're going to find any leader who's going to be well disposed to the land of Israel or the state of Israel. In the Republican Party, it's a little different. There are strains of isolationism in the Republican Party as well. And they're always have been in the conservative movement, anti-Israel voices, but they're a fringe group. And for the most part, they're kept as a fringe group. And the most passionate supporters amongst non-Jews in the American political system are now the Republicans. Mm-hmm. All depends who will succeed Trump. And that's an open question.
We shall see.
But I would say, amongst the potential successors, and they do span the spectrum of conservative political philosophy, there's not one I can think of who would identify as anti-Israel. Not even one.
Okay.
As opposed to the Democrats, mm-hmm. where several potential leaders obviously and openly identify as anti-Israel. And even the one who's perceived as a potential leader, Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, the one who was not selected by Kamala Harris because he was Jewish, mm-hmm. and that would really offend the Democratic base, even he has to tap dance around his support for Israel. So he'll say, yeah, he's very supportive of Israel, and I believe he's genuine, but there has to be a Palestinian state, and Israel can't be so aggressive, and we have to take care of Arab civilians, etc. So even his support for Israel has to be couched in arguments and policies that will tend, not just in the long term, but even in the short term, to weaken the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. So going back to my question about maintaining a Jewish presence in America or outside of Israel, doesn't sound like they have to be there.
I think if we had all Jews living in the land of Israel, it would take care of itself.
We'd be in good shape.
I think so.
Please God. So in the previous episodes on this season, both of our guests have encouraged people to reinvent themselves when make aliyah, be creative, follow your passions, and even change careers if needed. But for rabbis, educators, and community leaders whose careers are so closely tied to language, community, and cultural context, that reinvention can be much harder, especially midlife. What would you say to a rabbi or an educator who feels called to make Aliyah, but is struggling with the reality that their professional role may not easily transfer.
There are people who used to say that rabbis going to the land of Israel is like sending coals to Newcastle.
Right.
Which you could appreciate.
I can relate to.
Right. The truth is, there is a place for everyone here. As we know, there is some type of reinvention that has to take place if necessary. There are rabbis who are coming and starting communities if that's what they want to do. It sounds good in theory. Sometimes it even works in practice, but not always. Mm-hmm. And even today, there have been changes, but the Israeli mentality has not yet fully embraced the notion of a pulpit rabbi and a community shul. It is changing, but slowly.
Slowly.
Yet the average Israeli is not necessarily amenable to that. Language remains a barrier. I could speak, I'm in a little different stage in life, but I could speak of other colleagues who do come here and they do reinvent themselves away from the pulpit rabbi role. And they do become teachers. There are many schools. If they learn Hebrew, they open up even more opportunities. Some become tour guides. Some become, they enter real estate. I know one rabbi is in real estate now. Everyone finds his place. And I think a frustration would develop for a rabbi if you couldn't express the side or an aspect of the rabbinate that you are used to. So you take a typical rabbi. Even people who are involved in real estate or tourism, they could still teach.
Sure.
Give shiurim, mm-hmm. speak in different places, and
share their voice.
There are an infinite number of ways in which the voice of Torah can be propagated today, and rabbis have to find that. For example, I have a daily WhatsApp that I do. So things that are much more grounded, shiurim and lectures, but I do a 6-minute Torah WhatsApp. It goes out to 500 people or so. The feedback is very nice. So I get to say something every day, 6 days a week.
It's incredible, right?
Right, right.
So anyone and everyone can share their opinions and ideas
with
the world.
That is correct.
Look at this podcast.
That's correct. So if a person is willing to think a little out of the box, then there are many opportunities here in which people can make a real difference. I know people involved in Kirov. I know some of my former colleagues actually went to live in mixed communities to try to do some Kirov with Israelis.
Amazing.
Who are not religious.
Fantastic.
Not open to it. And they're a little scared off by a Haredi rabbinate.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that everybody can find to do. And when you find that, there is nothing that's more fulfilling in life.
But from a Parnassus perspective, making a living, it is more challenging than being in America. I mean, I think education and Kirov and the rabbinate, they pay better salaries.
Yes, that
than
is
they
true.
Do in Israel. So a young rabbi who has a family, a growing family, he needs to put bread on the table. He's got to buy a home. How would he manage?
That is true. You know, back in the day, they used to say, how do you make a small fortune in Israel? You come with a big fortune. Right? It's a little better than that today. But it is a factor. It's always best to come with something to do. In advance, you find something. You'll mm-hmm. be teaching here. You need an anchor. I mean, the government does facilitate Aliyah, so you have a little nest egg that can help you get by.
You can't rely on it.
You can't rely more than a year, right. So you have to find something. I do know people, even rabbis, who've come here with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start seeing where they could be of help and where they can earn a living. And yeah, some of them juggle a few jobs, but part of that is looking at the converse, and that's the expense of living a Jewish life in America. And a lot of those expenses no longer exist here. And the average American family, say of four children, American Jewish family of four children, could be spending $80,000, $100,000 a year in tuition on elementary school. When the kids go to high school, it'd be $30,000 $40,000 a year per child.
Wow.
Not to mention the healthcare expenses. We used to call them the wealthy poor. Like you couldn't really live in Teaneck, have a normal life, unless you're earning at least $250,000 a year.
Wow.
Here you'd be a king. But when you take out, you eliminate tuition, yeshiva tuition, and mortgage and health insurance, which could be $20,000, $25,000 a year. So those are big expenses that come right off the top. And right away, your income needs decrease dramatically. Mm-hmm. And that's a factor that I know people do weigh. Mm-hmm. In fact, someone said to me maybe 10 years ago that one of the great incentives for Aliyah in the years before I left was the price of yeshiva tuition. It was not only someone called it the greatest birth control in Jewish life, but it was an incentive for Aliyah. Because if you have four, some have five, and you're spending six figures right off the top on your child's yeshiva education, which will be a priority. And it was, it should be embarrassing for a person to be earning six figures over $200,000, $300,000 a year and coming to ask for scholarship assistance.
Crazy.
Which was reality also. You could be earning $200,000 a year.
So we need to add this to your three motivators. The fourth one is the cost of living.
Economics, that's correct. That was a big factor. And I think also when people did realize, and this is much more prevalent today than it was in the past, but people realized during the corona pandemic that you can work remotely.
Yeah.
And if businesses are amenable to that, then you can live in Israel and work American hours and get an American salary.
Can even be
salary.
In your interest to work in a different time zone because you're at an advantage.
That's correct. You could add to the productivity of the firm,
absolutely,
whatever you're doing. So that became a big factor as well. But yeah, there's no doubt that I'd never recommend to people just to come here and, you know, whatever happens, happens. Because not everyone is successful in Aliyah. Sometimes people have to go back. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people's expectations are different. You shouldn't come here and think you're going to live an American lifestyle. But you also should not think that you can come here and have no life's comforts. Mm-hmm. That's completely false.
Absolutely.
You can live here, have a very, very comfortable life. And yeah, not everybody has two or three cars here, but you realize it's not necessary to have two or three cars here.
Correct.
And so many other luxuries that we don't have here, but then you realize I don't really need them. My life gets... My life is quite full
and you
enriching
gain in other
without
ways.
It. You gain in many, many,
many other ways.
Ways.
So I would say about the three or four motivators, it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. It could be a little bit of each.
But, that's correct.
But the ratzon, the desire, the virtue to come.
I think the virtue has to be the essence.
It has to be there. It has to be the essence. I agree.
And that should be, you know, I think it should come from shuls, from the rabbis, and from the yeshivot also.
100%.
It's very nice to march in the Israeli Day Parade and even to have an Aliyah booth at the parade. But I think yeshivot should be underscoring the importance of living in the land of Israel as soon as children are old enough to understand what the state of Israel, the land of Israel, is. Fifth grade.
Well,
certainly high school.
Have things changed since October 7th?
I've been living here, so I don't have my finger on the pulse of the community to the extent that I once did. There was a time right after the war broke out where the commitment to living in the land of Israel was very, very overwhelming. And people said, we know people dropped everything. People who had fought, even lone soldiers who had fought in the army here, drop whatever, Americans, not Israelis, drop whatever they were doing to rejoin their units. So that was very powerful. It was demonstrative of people's inner commitment. Whether or not that translates into increased Aliyah, time will tell.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no doubt that the events of the last few years, the forced separation of the coronavirus and the war that was forced upon us as well, the viciousness of the enemy that I think so shocked normal people, shocked them to the extent that their people refused to believe it, because who could act so barbarously? I think that also has led to an increased passion amongst American Jews. And again, all it takes is, if not a leap of faith, I would say a leap of reality. A leap of virtue, maybe a better way to say it. A leap of virtue. This is what God wants from us. This is what the Torah is asking of us. Again, to state the obvious, Moshe Rabbeinu yearned to live in the land of Israel. The fact that he was denied the opportunity troubled him no end. Our sages say he davened 550 times, the count of Vayet Hanan, So Gotcha led him in the land of Israel. And here God is saying, come, it's open, Jew, come home.
Incredible.
We have to take advantage of that opportunity.
Incredible. Thank you, Rabbi Przanski. Before we wrap up, I have to ask you the two questions I ask all my guests. You've sort of alluded to this, but where in Israel do you live and what do you like about it?
I live in Modi'in, which is really in the center of the land of Israel. So when we first came here, I was on sabbatical and was writing my first book, and I decided I did not want to live in Yerushalayim, where all the American rabbis congregate. First of all, I'm not holy enough. I have to build myself up to that. Wow. It'll be a distraction. And I actually wanted to live amongst Israelis. Or little did I know, I'd be living amongst Anglos.
I was going to say, you're living in Buchman Modi'in, not too many Israelis.
I wanted to live among Israelis and in a mixed street.
I see.
I didn't need to live in a ghetto. I wanted to live amongst secular Israelis, religious. And it's an amazing thing. Everybody gets along. You know, it takes a little getting used to. You know, a guy's working on his car on Shabbat, and he says Shabbat Shalom. So as an American, as a rabbi, it takes getting used to.
Sure.
But they mean well. They don't know.
Right.
So I want to live in a mixed community and be in the center of the country. We're almost equidistant between Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And we have the mountains in the background that I see
Beautiful.
Every morning. The mountains of Binyamin. And it's just, it's God's gift to all of us.
Beautiful. And you're not the rabbi of the shul. You're just a
Not the
a
rabbi
regular.
Of the shul. But I get to teach. I get to complain and whine and moan.
The best of both worlds.
I get to daven. So it's thank God.
Beautiful. And we have the zchut to have you in our shul.
It's a blessing to be here.
Beautiful. Rabbi Przanski, if you were to move to another place in the country, where would you go and why?
My wife keeps asking me that. But we just had this discussion a few months ago, and I said, I can't see living anywhere else.
Wow.
Obviously, Hakol Olin Yerushalayim. Everybody always wants to ascend to Yerushalayim. But I'm quite content to live in Modi'in.
What a lovely way to live.
Yes, yes. There are many beautiful places in Israel, and there's really something for every temperament. I said this in the wrong place, but I once said to a group, where can you live that you can ski on the Hermon and you could swim and in the same day? But I said in Los Angeles and said, we could do that here also, which could be why so many Israelis live there. But nonetheless, we have every climate, every topography, weather's beautiful. It really is God's
blessing.
We're
blessed. We're lucky. So lucky. Thank you so much, Rabbi Przanski, for your insights, your passion, and your unwavering commitment to Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. I'm sure that your words today will move, inspire, and challenge many of our listeners to think more deeply about their own journey toward Israel. If anyone would like to reach out to Rabbi Przanski, you can find his writings and contact information on his blog at rabbiprzanski.com or can find his contact information in the show notes below. Thank you again for joining us. We look forward to having you back next week as we continue our journey of making Israel your home with another meaningful conversation and more inspiring insights. Until then, shalom ulehitraot.
Thank you for listening to On the House. A special thanks to Mordechai Gordon, our editor, who makes it all possible. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and share it with family and friends. For more insights, expert guidance, and access to listings and projects across Israel, visit buyitinisrael.com. That's buyitinisrael.com. Have a question or a topic you'd like Debbie to cover? You'll find contact details in the show notes. Whether you're planning Aliyah, searching for a home or a haven, or looking to support the Israeli economy, now is the time to buy it in Israel.